Jim Beam is putting a pause on bourbon production at one of its Kentucky distilleries this year. What challenges is the industry as a whole facing? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss the factors affecting Kentucky bourbon and how distillers are keeping spirits high are Kentucky Distillers Association President Eric Gregory and author of the new book, Bottom Shelf, How a Forgotten Brand of Bourbon Saved One Man's Life, Fred Minnick. Thanks for being here, Eric and Fred.
Thanks for having us, Lucy.
Yeah, good to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to have you both here. Fred, I want to start with you. Jim Beam, as I mentioned, is halting production for this entire year at one of its facilities in Kentucky. How big a deal is this?
Well, it is a big deal, but Jim Beam is massive. And they have another distillery that's about 7 miles south of there called the Booker No Distillery. You know, they're not going to really hurt from, you know, a capacity perspective, because that's the largest distillery in the state, one of the largest in the entire country, in the world even, the Booker No Distillery. And by the way, the Claremont facility that's being paused is, you know, that's probably in the top five in the country as well. It's huge as well. But, you know, the fact is like the market has caught up to what everybody was drinking in COVID, right? So there was this massive increase of investment and everything, a lot of it based on like COVID numbers. So there's a little bit of a course correction going on right now. And so they're simply making a decision to pause it now, then get caught flat-footed in, I would say, in the next 2-3 years. And also, they didn't lay anyone off, so that's a real positive. So they're just shifting people from that distillery to work in other facilities. And you've seen similar moves by other larger companies in the spirit space. And so what Jim Beam did, I think, took on a kind of a bigger emotional tie, because Jim Beam is so important, has always been important. It's been the number one selling bourbon brand, you know, since the late 70s. So I think anytime Jim Beam makes a move like that, it's always going to catch a lot of people's attention.
I saw a Gallup poll from last August that found the U.S. drinking rate has fallen to a 90-year low. Fred, what do you think's behind that? Are there health concerns, money concerns? What's going on there?
Well, I think a lot of it is the millennials drink so much, and, you know, and they're like starting to get into, they are starting to get themselves into like to drink less. And the younger generation doesn't drink as much as the millennials did. And then you've got like the baby boomers, who are at the age where, you know, they probably shouldn't be mixing alcohol with certain medications and so forth. So they're kind of like phasing out of the data. So you've got a couple things happening. You got the younger generation not drinking as much as the millennials. And then you have the baby boomers, who did drink quite a bit, kind of exiting the data that we have. But I will say that the younger generation does drink bourbon, but they like the more expensive stuff. So they usually don't want to start with like that $15, $20 product that we started out with. They don't want to pay their dues like we did. They want to go straight to the high top shelf. But they also don't have as much money today, you know, and they don't want to go into more debt. This generation is very responsible in a lot of ways. And there's also the competition of cannabis, which was not there legally anyway when I was growing up.
Well, Eric, there are still plenty of people spending money on expensive bourbon, though, right? What's the industry seeing in Kentucky overall in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, Kentucky, and I agree with Fred on all the things he just said, by the way. Yeah, I mean, Kentucky's always been kind of the bellwether. You know, all eyes are always on Kentucky when it comes to bourbon, because we birthed it, you know, 200-something years ago, and we've definitely perfected it over the last couple of centuries. You know, we're seeing a lot of the same things as alcohol in general is seeing. I mean, it's not just bourbon that's down. Beer and wine are down. Beer is really down, unfortunately, and that's having an effect. But I think from an American whiskey category, you're just seeing a lot of, you know, adaptation. People are adapting to the new normal of the impacts of everything from the tariffs to, as Fred mentioned, the generational drinking habits that you've got on, the introduction of cannabis and THC infused beverage that is definitely having impact, and even things like Ozempic and the weight loss drugs, you know, that not only curb your appetite, but they curb your alcohol cravings. All these things have kind of hit as like a perfect storm at once, you know, that has slowed sales of all alcohol. And then you've got the economy in general and the competition for the leisure dollars I was at a conference last summer, and one of the consultants pointed out, you know, your competition necessarily is cannabis as much as Netflix. You know, you think about, you've got a Netflix subscription and a Hulu subscription and an HBO subscription and everything else. Suddenly, a lot of the money that you were spending on going out to eat or, you know, picking up a bottle somewhere is not there anymore. So it's definitely an interesting time with a lot of headwinds. But I will say this, from a Kentucky standpoint, I'm still very confident and bullish on Kentucky bourbon. My predecessor used to say, you know, you can make bourbon anywhere in the United States, but if you want to sell it, it better have the name Kentucky on the label.
I was going to say to that point, this is like, you know, from a historical perspective, when these times have come, this is the first time when there has been a downturn in bourbon that there's been a tourism arm. And I've long said that the tourism arm is something that can save Kentucky bourbon. You have people coming from all over the world out here for their bachelorette parties and their bachelor parties. You know, Kentucky is a destination because of bourbon. And you're actually seeing that, you know, the distilleries are selling their exclusive bottles out of their gift shops. Those are massive revenue generators. So all the effort that Eric and a lot of people have done in the last like 20 years to create this tourism movement is really paying off right now when Kentucky bourbon sales at a liquor store in, say, New York or North Dakota are not doing as well as they did 5 years ago.
Yeah, Lucy, that's a really good point. And in fact, I remember the day we had this conversation in 2014. We were looking at wine sales, and wine sales have been going down for, what, Fred, 20-something years. Mm-hmm. But people are still, you know, flocking to Napa and Sonoma and places like that. It is a huge tourism destination. And we were in a meeting and said, if bourbon ever does have one of these points in history where we have a dip or some challenges that are out of our control, we need tourism to help back us up. So we went on a mission, a 10-year mission of changing alcohol laws in Kentucky to give the distilleries a lot of privileges that had been stuck in prohibition, like even just buying a cocktail at a distillery wasn't available until 2016. So doing that and building up the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Adventure, you know, has really been a blessing, because it's Fred's right. It's helped me keep the doors on in a lot of places, the doors open in a lot of places.
We're talking about the challenges facing Kentucky bourbon and how distillers are responding. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So, Eric, can you talk briefly about the aging process that's such an important part of bourbon production? Because that, I imagine, poses some challenges for distilleries, too, when they're trying to think ahead and figure out what people are going to want, what the market's going to be like.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Lucy. You know, a lot of people, I think we just seem to forget that the barrels that are being filled today won't be ready to drink until 2032, right? So we've got distillers that have experts that are constantly pouring over data and market data and demographics and everything, trying to see what the future is going to be like and what the markets are going to be, especially the global markets in the next 5, 6, 10 years. So there's a lot of crystal ball that goes into it in the first place. Then you throw in the uncertainty of some of the challenges that we've said here, and then the global, you know, geopolitical things that are going on right now, and tariffs and differing trade policies and things. And that uncertainty has really kind of thrown a monkey wrench into a lot of the planning. So I think part of the things like you've seen Jim Beam doing and others is we have so many barrels aging in Kentucky right now. People are just kind of holding back a little bit to see how this all settles out. Because again, the blessing and curse of bourbon is you can't make it overnight. So they're doing the right things, and I think they're being very conservative and very professional and taking a break and seeing how this happens instead of just dumping all this whiskey on the market and causing chaos.
And the state charges a tax on those barrels of bourbon that are aging too, don't they? I mean, that's got to be something that folks are thinking about.
Yeah, Fred's thinking to himself, oh, here he goes.
Yeah.
Kentucky is the only place in the world that taxes aging barrels of spirits. They don't do it in Scotland or Ireland or cognac or even Tennessee whiskey. So if you're lucky enough to find a bottle of 18-year-old Knob Creek or Elijah Craig, that thing's been taxed 18 times while it evaporates, again, adding insult to injury. And, you know, it's just something that the Kentucky for generations has seen bourbon as a sin industry and a revenue source. You know, I think it's really, we've really helped in the past few years to kind of redefine it as a more of a signature industry and, you know, in a lot of different ways. But I will say this, and we worked with the legislature, well, the KDA has worked with the legislature for 75 years to tackle that issue. And finally, a couple of years ago, we had a great compromise that was worked out that will actually phase out that barrel tax over the next 17 years, slowly phase it out. And we did a lot of things to make sure that money that went back to schools, it keeps schools whole, it keeps local fire districts whole, things like that. Because a lot of that money goes back to very vital programs, not only education, but emergency services and things. And you know, none of our distilleries wanted to jeopardize any of that funding because, you know, they live and work and play in those communities. So that's the last thing that they would want. But it does take away a discriminatory tax on bourbon that had really put us at an uncompetitive disadvantage in the global marketplace. But also, quite frankly, was just spiraling out of control as we have, as the inventory grows. So for example, just 5 years ago, the distillers paid $20 million in barrel taxes. And last year, that number was $75 million.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Yeah.
So it may hit $100 million this year.
And there was a period they couldn't even write off paying those taxes. That's another part of this is like they would pay all these taxes and then they couldn't even write it off on their next year's books.
Yeah. Yeah. It has been so difficult because, you know, we've really had to do a lot of education and work with our partners in local communities to, you know, to work with them so they understand that at the end of the day, you know, these distilleries are still businesses. And, you know, you can make bourbon in Kentucky and age it for a year and put Kentucky on the label, but there's nothing to say that you couldn't move that barrel out of Kentucky for the next 3 years and avoid all those taxes. Mm. And, you know, there were concerns, legitimate concerns that some distilleries were looking to put warehouses in southern Indiana, right across the river from Louisville, or even, you know, Ohio or Tennessee in places to start, you know, figuring out a solution to those taxes. And if that would have happened, you know, then schools would have been impacted and fire and emergency services and things like that. So we were much more comfortable working on a long-term solution that gives these communities a pretty good landing space, you know, over the next 17 years to figure out ways to diversify their local economy, but also kind of wean themselves a little bit off this source of revenue.
We've got a lot more to talk about. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, an art exhibition at the CAC explores revolution and a family story of escape. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to continue our discussion about Kentucky bourbon, the challenges facing the industry, and how distillers are responding to keep spirits high. My guests are author of Bottom Shelf, How a Forgotten Brand of Bourbon Saved One Man's Life, Fred Minnick, and Kentucky Distillers Association President Eric Gregory. You can join the conversation. Just call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at WVXU.org. We did get a caller just before the break. She didn't want to stay on the line, but Linda was curious about tariffs. And Fred, let me ask you about that. What kind of impact are tariffs having on the industry? And then I'm going to come back to another email that we got from Deborah. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of related maybe, but Deborah emails, perhaps I missed it, but I didn't hear any mention of the fact that Canadians are boycotting American alcohol and other products ever since President Trump threatened them with becoming our 51st state. Can you talk about those factors a little bit, Fred?
Yeah, so I'll start with the retaliatory tariffs on American whiskey. Right now, there's really only one that's from China. The European Union has a 30% one, but that, if I'm not mistaken, Eric, is supposed to come off like February 5th.
Supposed to come back at 50% by March. If they don't have a trade deal. Yeah.
So if they don't have a trade, so it's supposed to end. If it doesn't end, it's going to come back at 50. That's what it is. Yeah. The biggest thing has been Canada. coming, you know, just flat out boycotting. They didn't even try the tariff route. They just had provincial leaders like say, take it all off the shelf. And that's the real big difference between this wave of tariffs versus the last one in the Trump administration. The last one, you know, Canada just, you know, volleyed back and forth on tariffs and debating. This time they just straight up completely said, oh yeah, well, okay, we're going to block you. Now, that had some repercussions on them, in my opinion, because Diageo moved their bottling facility for Crown Royal. And, you know, that's a staple Canadian whiskey. And there's even talks now that they're going to begin, Canada's going to begin boycotting Crown Royal, which is a Canadian product, because of them moving the bottling facilities. So I don't know how this is going to play out for Canada. I think it was probably, you know, when it came to the saying that they're going to become the 51st state of the United States, right? They reacted with bravado, and I don't know where that's going to go. I really don't, from a spirits perspective. I do know that it absolutely hurt the spirits category from the American side of things. And I also say that in the 1980s, Canada was beginning to test for a particular carcinogen that Jim Beam was vulnerable to, and they were going to be cleared off the shelves in Canada in the 1980s, but they ended up buying national distillers, and that would lower their carcinogen level of this particular thing that they were testing for. It's a big part of my new book coming out, but I'll tell you that all of these things have more impact than sales themselves. It creates this like a consumer confidence issue, and we're in a state in the world where you have to be on one side or another. Bourbon has always been the kind of like the conduit for two sides to get together and to be able to like hash through problems. I mean, this has always been a thing. Like congressmen and statesmen could always, you know, find a hotel room and have a glass of bourbon and talk through some situations. What all of this does for me is it takes that out of the equation. And bourbon being a political pawn is not only dangerous for the sales of bourbon, but I think what it does more than anything is it really takes away that middle part of us kind of finding ways to get along and figure out solutions to problems that we are kind of like really lacking as a society right now.
Yeah, bourbon brings people together.
Without a doubt.
That's what we always say. And Lucy, one other thing, just real quick on tariffs that people may not realize, you know, we send the majority of our used barrels to Scotland for use in producing Scotch whiskey. And there's a 10% tariff on Scotch right now coming into the United States, and Scotch is losing about a million pounds a week because of that tariff. So they're curtailing production there, just like we're doing here in Kentucky. But because of that, the used barrel trade is basically dried up, and that's about $400 million in revenue that comes back to Kentucky distillers to send those barrels over there. So when you're looking at all these things, again, that's kind of creating this, you know, these headwinds for the industry, certainly the loss of a used barrel market is a big one.
Yeah. We got an email from SD who writes, Jim Beam and other Kentucky distilleries survived prohibition. Might be tough, but I suspect they'll survive the current tariffs and market challenges too. Eric, what do you, when you talk to the folks in the industry, what are people seeing as the biggest headwinds that they're facing, and what's their outlook? Do they feel good about going forward even with all these things swirling around?
Yeah, I think the foundation of Kentucky bourbon is strong, and it always will be. You know, we've got over 23,000 people in Kentucky employed. We're a $9 billion industry. We pay, you know, $360 million in tax revenue. And like your email said, we've been around for 200 years. We're going to be around for 200 more. And I'm confident in that. This is just an industry that has gone through a boom in the past 15 years and is maturing. And like all U.S. alcohol or all alcohol in the world, you know, sales are kind of leveling out after COVID, and we're dealing with the aftermath of that. But there's hand wringing definitely going on, you know, in the industry over things like tariffs in Canada and stuff that's out of our control, but we're not turning off the stills, right? You don't want to be caught in 2030 something, not worried about having put down enough whiskey. We wish you would have done that back in 2027, right? So, you know, even though, you know, Jim Beam is scaling back a little bit at Claremont, I think people are still very confident that, you know, once we get the trade policies worked out and some of these other issues, these cyclical issues that aren't really structural, they're more cyclical. Once those kind of, you know, in their wave, that we'll come out stronger than ever on the other side. We always do.
And Lucy, there's another issue that doesn't really get talked about a lot. And that is there was for about a 5-year period between 2018 and 2023, there was an enormous movement of investors outside of the spirit space just coming in and buying up lots and warehouses filled of bourbon and working with brokers and trying to use bourbon as kind of like they would like a stock portfolio. And those people have largely exited and or have been trying to sell their barrels. And so when you have like a group of people who have no intention of starting a brand or actually, you know, improving the industry, they're just in there based solely on making money like they would off of a mutual fund with no passion for the industry that's usually filled with people with passion. That had a massive impact on the wholesale side and a lot of behind the scenes barrel prices that we're feeling today. And that's an inside baseball kind of conversation. But the truth is, that's another little metric that's had a big impact on where we are right now is when venture capitalists and people who are looking at bourbon as like we would a mutual fund.
Yeah, it's actually probably cheaper, Fred, I don't know if you agree with this, to buy a barrel on the open market right now than it is to make it.
Yeah, heck, you could buy a barrel of like 8-year-old bourbon for cheaper than you could a bottle of King of Kentucky.
Oh my gosh.
That's how cheap it is for a barrel of 8-year-old bourbon right now.
We have a caller on the line, but we're running out of time. So, Amit, I'm going to share your comment with our guests. Amit says, spent some time in Toronto, and their old fashions were underwhelming compared to Kentucky. So there you go. We appreciate that endorsement. You talked about the importance of the bourbon trail, the tourism that you've ramped up. Just remind us very quickly, Eric, what does it take for a whiskey to be a bourbon? I mean, you said they can be made anywhere. We're running out of time, but just in 30 seconds or so, what does a whiskey have to be a bourbon?
Yeah, not all whiskey is bourbon. Well, Fred, you can understand this. Okay, so the main difference between whiskey and bourbon is bourbon has to be aged in new charred oak barrels, whereas most other whiskey is aged in a used barrel, and it's got to be at least 51% corn. Now, there's some other things, you know, like it's got to be aged 2 years to be straight. It can only be barreled at 125 proof. It can be bottled at less than 80 proof and things like that. But really, it's that barrel that changes, I think, the way that you look upon American whiskey and bourbon. Being that brand new barrel, you get the first chance of that liquid, you know, really going in and out of that charred wood and extracting all those natural sugars and vanillas.
Yeah.
And so that's what gives us that amber look and the great taste.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Kentucky Distillers Association President Eric Gregory and author of Bottom Shelf, How a Forgotten Brand of Bourbon Saved One Man's Life. Fred Minnick, thank you both so much for your time today. It's been great. Up next, an exhibition at the CAC explores revolution and a family story of escape. This is Cincinnati Edition.